Morning, everyone. Today is Thursday, May 3rd, 2018. It is 9 a.m. We're meeting for the County Administration Workshop in the Board of County Commissioners Conference Room. President Commissioner Hare, Commissioner Morgan, and Commissioner DeYoung. We're going to start off today with Department Business. 1A is Community Development and subsection Accessory Dwelling Unit Discussion.
So okay.
I'll let you have it, Julie.
Okay. So in 2017, we declared an emergency housing declaration, and then the board passed an order for me to work on housing amendments that could help provide more affordable housing, availability of housing, etc. So I've worked on some amendments, and I have 20 pages of amendments, but I didn't want to overwhelm you with those. So what I wanted to do was start with one sector of this and work through that. And then a week at a time, kind of go through chunks of it so the board understands what we're coming into. I think it's just going to be easier that way. So I started with the accessory dwelling units. And I sent you a little handout on understanding what they are and how they're treated. But in a nutshell, what we have in our county right now is we have something called a medical hardship program. And the state allows us to have that. And what the medical hardship program is intended to do is if you are a caregiver or you need care, you can get a temporary use permit for a medical hardship dwelling. And then a person can go out there and live in a camper or a mobile home or stick-built structure. It is by far the most abused program in my department because what it is it's just a second home. It's a way to get a second home. They don't remove them.
What's the criteria for, don't they have to, a doctor, a note from your doctor or anything?
They do. They need a note from the doctor. But, you know, we'll often see it advertised, like on Craigslist, that looking for somebody with medical condition, I have a medical hardship to rent and things of that nature. So, and a lot of them, it's constantly a struggle to follow up on because every year you have to have them give you documentation and doctor notes. The majority do not. So,
well, we've seen in a certain prescription that just about everybody becomes a doctor.
Yes.
At some point in time. I mean, you know, there's an industry out there that an awful lot of patients out there that popped up out of nowhere and people that would write prescriptions for them.
Right. And that's, we kind of have the same thing going with this program.
Okay.
So when I looked at the housing, I looked at our intent, which was to create more long-term housing units. I looked at this program and I said, you know what? Let's just give it a clear path. Let's just call it what it is, and that's an accessory dwelling unit. So the problem with having accessory dwelling units in the county is, by state law, we can't have them outside of an urban growth boundary. So effective the first of the year, we can have them in an urban growth boundary, but beyond that, a county cannot. So I had to struggle with the way the codes were written. And I talked to DLCD, Department of Land Conservation Development, which is our oversight committee, and they said, if you have a hot plate, we'll let you have, not call it an accessory dwelling unit, but we'll let you have it if you have a hot plate in there. And I said, well, I don't get it because, you know, that's, what's the difference if it's a hot?
Good single burner versus a stove.
Right. Because in Jackson County, they do have these little guest houses, and they get by having hot plates in them. So I did my research, and I challenged them, and I said, here's my data on how many fires there are from hot plates.
Say the exact same
thing. And they came back, and they said, okay, we'll let you have a flat-top cooking surface, like a strong top. I'm like, okay, that's good. And then I ran into my next hurdle, which was DEQ, because we wanted to keep it affordable. We wanted to allow them to tie into the existing septic system. So if you have a four-bedroom home, and then maybe, I'm sorry, if your septic is sized for four bedrooms, perhaps your house is only three, why not let them have that one unit ADU and tie into it? And DEQ said no. They said in order for us to do that, Josephine County would have to propose rulemaking at the state. They said we only allow that for a temporary use. And I said, so you would allow a three-bedroom mobile home put out there as a medical hardship that never gets removed tied into the existing septic? And they said yes, because it's authorized as a temporary use. So I said, okay, let's get rid of the medical hardship program, make it an accessory dwelling unit program, but let's call them temporary use accessory dwelling units.
Does that not just invite mobile homes and trailers throughout the county?
It did. It did. This program gets rid of the medical hardship program and says if you want an accessory dwelling unit, temporary accessory dwelling unit, and we don't define temporary, you would be able to have that, but it has to be stick-built or built elsewhere and brought on site.
What about the whole precipitation of the tiny house being on a trailer?
Okay.
And that's by nature in a temporary state, but people built really nice little tiny homes on the platform of a trailer, so it'll be 8 by 20 or whatever, and that qualifies in its temporary nature because it's got wheels under it. Now they put, you know, block temporary foundations on under them. I toured them all over. I mean, they had them at the ADU conference we went to up in Portland. That was the resounding element between all of them, is they're all on a trailer. And if something doesn't work out, the next purchaser of that property is not interested. It isn't exactly conforming, so it's temporary in nature. They can just remove it. And I think that whole reason of why it's on a trailer and why other people are using it that way is because it qualifies under that temporary...
Well, in the rest of the world, not in Oregon.
Okay.
So in Oregon, the state of Oregon said if you have these tiny... They don't recognize something called a tiny home. But if you have a tiny home on wheels, that is recognized in the state of Oregon as a recreational vehicle. Mm-hmm. It has to be in an RV park, or it's limited in duration to 30 days or 120 days, depending on the zone. We, of course, want long-term housing. We're trying to meet a housing need here.
Yeah, they sit there forever. I mean, it's just...
Yeah. So, but if I can jump ahead to that, Commissioner, real quick. So one of the things I did do in the 20 pages was made a provision that we would allow parks for these, where people could come in and maybe it is just all the tiny homes on wheels, that type of thing, under the guise of a campground. Because otherwise we cannot, by state law, have a tiny home on wheels outside of a campground
it's
in Josephine County.
So it's an RV.
Yeah. So we're really...
So do families not get to have an RV pad at their own house?
Yeah. They just can't use it for more than 30 or 120 days as an actual residence, legally.
That whole thing just doesn't make any sense at all, but I think we all get that.
Right. So I'm just going to go through...
The intent is that people aren't living in RVs. RVs is not necessarily intended for full-time. Most of them
are. No, they're not.
But we have so many that are. Either while a house is being built or that's all they can stay in, there's nowhere else to go.
Trying to facilitate the practical application under state laws. We all understand the reality of it. And we're trying to find, you know, all of these people are in violation. We get the reality of it. That's why we're talking about this. If we don't want to address it, there's another option. We just don't enforce, you know, non-compliant ADUs until they get to compound state or something of that nature. I mean, that's definitely up to the board to just say, hey, we're going to allow one. We're not going to, by not allow it, we're just not going to enforce to the point of which they get two or something.
I would rather see an accessory dwelling that's built to code for the sake of safety than allow trailers that are more fire hazards than anything.
So we'll go through what I have proposed here for the ADU, but I just also want you to understand everything that I'm looking at, because it all ties together. So we're looking at the medical hardship program because that affects the accessory dwelling unit because we have to call it temporary. We currently allow something called bedrooms and garages.
What's that called?
Bedrooms and garages.
So like a guest bedroom over a garage or something like that?
Yes, and that too has been a disaster, to be honest with you. I mean, they're not built to code oftentimes. They turn into the guest house. We're constantly chasing these, you know, we're little squirrels out there chasing all these things. So, again, let's give them a path to do it the correct way, which is the ADU. It's this exact same thing. That way, if you have a bedroom in a garage and you end up putting a kitchen sink in there, you're not in violation. You're just an ADU. So, looking at the accessory dwelling units.
But doesn't it have to be an accessory if it's a attached to the house, that's not an accessory.
Well, so under the accessory dwelling unit, I'm going to talk about an accessory dwelling unit attached and detached.
Okay.
So we'll look at it that way. So, Commissioner DeYoung, you had concerns when we talked a couple months ago about housing, transitional housing or housing that doesn't have to meet code. So I looked at, and that's really hard because to be a single family home in Oregon, there are very strict building codes on that. But
I'm just talking energy codes and things like that. So starter home of sorts that you, that's a class of house. And it doesn't meet, it doesn't say that you've got to have a 98% efficient gas furnace or you don't have any heat. Mm-hmm. You know, it just doesn't make any sense that we are telling people that they have to build a $300,000 house,
yeah.
Even though it's 700 square feet for my mother-in-law or my grandmother. But by golly, it's got to be a thermos bottle type because, you know, that just keeps raising the price up to where people just can't do it. And they start throwing stuff together.
Right.
If there was a category, that would be
it. But they don't get it permitted. I mean, they just do it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And it shows movement in the direction of saying, okay, we realize that everybody doesn't knock back 6 digits a year and can afford a mortgage of $3,000 or $4,000 a month. That there is something we can do and live there. Like I said, I'll use JD's apartments. I lived there 50 years ago. Baseboard heater, 2x4 walls, still standing, still heating. Everybody's fine.
Well, so some of the other things was transitional housing, which is a stick-built shelter intended to provide temporary shelter for veterans, homeless individuals, and families, or those transitioning to or from homelessness. So I have some examples of those, you know, where you have your shared, maybe a house where you're all just sharing one common kitchen. I have transitional housing camps. I have transitional housing shelter, which will be quite controversial, I think. I looked at farm use labor housing and looked at the barracks style housing. Mm-hmm.
That's really important. The state's limit to 30 days in a lot of situations for even harvesting. I mean, there's different rotations that they go through. It's not conducive.
It's not. And, you know, for us with the... So the state will allow some farm labor housing.
Yeah.
However, not in association with a marijuana crop, and that is one of our big crops right now. So how do we get from...
Tell them to put a tomato plant in the ground. It's for that one.
Can they all hover around it?
Actually, they have to meet to qualify for that farm...
It's
for
really
the state,
strict.
It is. You have to produce a certain amount of money on there every year, averaged out. Type
so the
of
biggest
soils.
One that we have in Josephine County, does anybody know? It's a blueberry farm out there on the Applegate. They've got capacity, I think, for 30, 60 people. They're wanting to do 60. And it's limited for 30 days. So they've got to pick the right day. They own a motel in town, which is the overflow for the housing that they have out there at the farm. I've been out there. I've taken a look at it. It's really nice. They've got a dinner area. Everything's catered, 3 meals a day. And it's pretty efficient. And everything's permitted, you know, all the way through. And they just want, they need more space. They've got 160 acres of blueberries there. They generate a couple million dollars of revenue. They've got all of these locally sourced stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they're a major, you know, producer, and they'd love to expand in Josephine County and the state of Oregon. They're in Washington as well, but there's such a limitation. They own a hotel. That's where they do
just
their,
to satisfy
just to satisfy their housing element.
Well, maybe they should be an example. I mean, you just gave a very compelling argument why that
there's
needs
a lot of
needs to be changed.
There's yeah, there's a lot
there's
of, a lot of smaller operations that don't have the bandwidth to buy a hotel.
Right.
Know.
And when you look at the problems we've had over the last 2 years with these campers, the compounds, the guns going off, let's give them a path to do it right.
Good.
Well, and, you know, no offense, when I had to go to the police academy in McMinnville before it was moved to Salem, I stayed in barracks at the Oregon Military Academy. And, you know, everybody had a closet kind of there, and you stayed in bunk beds, and you had showers and bathrooms at the end that it were shared communal with the barrack next door. And it was clean, it was fine, and workforce housing in that situation that's temporary should be allowed to do that. It's what's going on right now. We got the greenhouses where they're living and they're going to the bathroom in buckets and spreading it on the ground. How is that better?
Yep. So I looked at all that. I looked at we have this thing called temporary storage of a mobile home. It's meant to, if you're pulling something off, to give you time to work on it and then pull it onto a new site. What it becomes is a permanent mobile home without septic. So looked at some stuff on that. Looked at the idea of emergency permitting. At the current time, if your house burns down, you have to go through that whole long hoop. There should be some provision where you can get that permit pretty quick. So I want to put something in there for that. Want to look at revising the definition of boarding house to encourage more of that. Farm stays, cleaning up the definition of floor area, footprint, introducing hostels, because we don't have hostels right now. Retreat center, defining tiny home, making a provision for a tourist home, and then addressing yurts, because yurts are, we get a lot of calls on yurts. And again, by state law, you cannot live in a yurt. A yurt cannot be used as a dwelling. So we need to make that pretty clear in our code how to address the yurt.
Okay, I have a question on that. Yurts can't be used in a dwelling, yet we rent them out in some of our parks. Is that different?
They're not a dwelling. There's a
it's a camp. It's like a campsite.
The duration of time.
Yeah. A camp.
It's 14 days, I believe. You can't lease it from us. For more than 14 days consecutively. You have to leave, and there's a certain amount of time you have to leave, and then you can come back if you want. But
14 days establishes residency, and so we'd have to actually evict them if they stayed longer than that.
It's a mess.
Yeah, so anyways, that's a whole other issue. Then I look at the camping.
Private campgrounds don't have that limitation. That's imposed by us.
Well,
because we don't want it to serve as long-term residences. But we also lose out on revenue because people who want to winter when it's cheaper here or something. There's a lot of places that RV camps are full. We don't allow them so that people don't stay there for 30 days and 90 days. That's a really lucrative thing for the private sector that does that.
And they can only have a certain percentage of them can be yurts. I mean, it's pretty tight.
Yeah.
So I look at camping and campgrounds. Then we get into more expensive housing, I'll put it that way. What can we do for people that, want a 1,400 square foot home and the lots are too expensive? So how do we address getting more affordable lots? So I look at allowing private roads and road easements instead of paved graveled roads. I look at cluster subdivisions, allowing cluster subdivisions where you're doing more density control. The state right now says the smallest you could have, if you had an RR1 or RR2.5 zoning, the smallest lot you could have is 2 acres. RR5 has to be 5 acres. I come from the argument where that is a big waste of land, and why not allow them to be clustered? So you're looking at density. So if you have 40 acres, RR5, and you can have 8 homes.
So she's talking about a planned subdivision comes to us, and we've done a couple of these. There's Whitaker.
Well, there's the planned unit development route, which still requires, it's a lot more, this would be a much more simpler process.
Yeah.
Where you cluster them.
Yeah.
But the remainder of that land has to be held into perpetuity by either a neighboring farmer or something, so that can't be further subdivided. So what you're doing is you're protecting farmland, but you're allowing for smaller lots tighter together, which are more affordable.
So since 8 homes can be on the 40 acres, you're just putting the 8 homes in a smaller plot, leaving the rest of the land open,
right, for carbon space.
Or resource land can't be done. You can't do that resource zone land. So are you talking about that? Because RR5 is not typically on resource zone lands.
Right.
If you're going to rezone it and get one of these things, you've got a threshold to get through.
You're restricted on the lands that you could put it.
So don't talk about the designation. You're talking about an RR zone, right?
I'd have to go through this, but I believe it's for RR only.
So you mentioned farmland. It's non-resource zone land. It's RR. But I like the idea of clustering it. It provides greater open space if people choose that as an option.
It's just an option.
We're not mandating that they cluster. But a lot of them kind of want to. They want, cuts down on infrastructure costs when you're putting in roads to serve a 60-acre potential subdivision, you've got 11 possible spots out there. It makes a lot of sense to just have a road and a cul-de-sac, and everybody kind of has their own. But then it goes back, and you've got, you know, maybe
trails,
30 acres of common area.
Private gardens, trails. The other thing is there's incentive. So if you're willing to cluster, you perhaps get an extra lot. So instead of normally you'd have 8 lots, maybe you get a 9th one because you're willing to cluster. So that's all written in here. So we'll go through those. Making options for flagpole, because the flagpole right now, if you understand.
Flag lot.
Yeah, so if you have a lot behind a lot, instead of just giving them an easement, we require this wasted strip of land that comes down, and we'll go through all of that.
It counts against the total. So if you had 10, you can't do a flag lot of our R5. Because you have to count the other space.
You would have to, the driveway would go with the back one, which shorts the front one.
I guess you can, it's just...
And everybody thinks that flagpole gives them access to a road, and then they can't get the road access spacing standards. And
the current code requires every developed lot to have access.
Yes.
And an easement doesn't qualify as access. So there's a lot of developable properties that don't necessarily want to put a flag in it to count against the primary property owners, but it would love to give them an easement to the driveway to approach. I can think of half a dozen of those right now. People have come forward and they're like, well, I guess I can't develop because the code says this, and it's a shortcoming.
It's very restrictive.
Yeah.
And it also gives false hope that you own land to a road that you can't do anything with. So, looking at... So private roads and road easements would have to have a recorded maintenance agreement to avoid, you know, who's maintaining it.
Well, that's a great idea, because there's just dozens of roads out there that aren't maintained because nobody can agree on what the ratio of cost is. You know, the guy at the end, he's bearing all the costs because he has to drive the furthest, and the guy at the beginning has none. I see that a lot.
So we look at setbacks from private road easements, so people aren't building right up to it and blocking it. The cluster subdivision. Cluster subdivision is quite a few pages.
I like the idea of you giving us all of that, and we pick the most either pressing or the lowest low-hanging fruit, the easy stuff to get through, like the road easement. That may be on page 18, but I want to do that tomorrow because that's easy.
Does it require an ordinance?
Yes.
So all of this will require an ordinance. My recommendation is pulling out the stuff the state is going to have a real issue with and do those separate. So
all of these should be separate because if they're challenged, I don't want them to...
Like what we did
last time was not the way I like to do things. We can do them all at the same time, but they're separate ordinances. So that they can
stand on their own feet.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so we don't jeopardize it one for the other.
Right.
So what I'm going to do is, so we'll keep going through the ADU right now, and I'll make it quick if I can. And then just so you know, next week I'm going to bring you another chunk. And once we get through it, I'll do a full-blown public hearing.
Okay.
Is there a way that we can get
that
packed so I can be reading through it? Because I want it to, you know, my first look at the ADU, I didn't want it something temporary. I want to actually give people homes that are safe, that aren't just trailer parks.
That's why she's here today to talk about the whole reason. You know, I was just share your opinion.
There's a reason to
call it temporary.
Yep.
I hear you, but I think part of it too is getting some time to process and think through some thoughts. So by the time you come
and also
in,
context, how does it relate to you know, the shared easement component of putting up whatever?
Yeah, it really does. It really does take explaining to understand how the pieces fit together.
Yeah.
So we'll just keep, but I will send that out.
Mm-hmm.
I have any time.
It's a crazy weekend, but.
Okay, so let me just go real quick with the accessory dwelling units, okay? We need definitions. So what I have is an accessory dwelling unit shall mean a temporary single-family residence, which is ancillary to the legal primary dwelling on the lot or parcel, and has a flat cooking surface but no oven. The intent of the accessory dwelling unit is to provide incidental in size non-transient housing. Tiny homes on wheels are not considered accessory dwelling units. Airbnbs are not considered accessory dwelling units because they do not meet a long-term housing need. So we're just clarifying that right from the get-go.
Can I have a question before you go? Because you say it cannot have an oven. Can you specify it cannot have a convection oven, which is a regular oven, but can they have a microwave?
They can have a microwave.
Well, that's considered a microwave oven. And so, you know, if you just say can't have an oven, some inspector is going to say, get that oven out of here. But a microwave is a microwave oven.
My microwave is a convection.
A regular microwave is a convection oven. Mm-hmm. So.
They have really nice toaster ovens.
I have one.
I do too.
Yeah. I don't ever use it, but.
I've never used my actual oven.
After you get the permit and the people are living in there, you can move stuff in and out. They're going to do it anyway. But I just don't want them to think that they can't have an oven and that grandma has to eat inside the house every day.
Well, you know what? We recently were dealing with a housing situation with senior housing, and one of the regulations for those units is they weren't having ovens. They were having this stovetop. But in order to accommodate, they had a communal kitchen that would provide that ability. If there's a way, well, I know you're trying to find a way to live within the code and or to state regulations, but
what's crazy is we're going to get chastised for how stupid of a code. Hey, we don't disagree. Well, it's the best we can do, right?
We want to provide safe housing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think there's anything unsafe about having an oven. What's wrong with that?
I agree.
I would think a cooktop is far more dangerous.
Yeah.
And they're going to set something on a cooktop and turn the oven on and burn the whole place down.
One of the other reasons we have to watch it on the whole kitchen aspect is because DEQ, when I challenged on it, they said there's a kitchen in there and therefore we're going to require a separate septic. I'm like, well, what does that mean? You size your septics based on the number of bedrooms. But it was the idea of a kitchen. So we'll play the kitchen game.
I don't know. I know that's a fight for another day, but we're dealing with DEQ in another area that is not practical. We have studies showing how much land we have out at the airport for the septic system, and DEQ is saying it's a
crime. We have our own study that says that there's plenty of permeability.
Yeah.
The other thing is, you know, we don't have to just totally acquiesce on everything.
No.
We can push back on some stuff and just say, we're going to do this. That's one of the benefits of breaking it up. So let's start with a good foundation, and if we want to add on later, totally conscious. This one's
I apologize for the oven comment. We'll just move along. Let's let you go through.
So then they don't allow, you know, we don't allow duplexes in the state of Oregon. So
we don't?
Not outside of a
city. Out of the urban growth boundary, so in a city.
So what we are proposing, what I am proposing is an accessory dwelling unit attached shall mean a portion of the primary dwelling structure dedicated to or converted for use as an accessory single-family dwelling. Such attached housing is either in the primary dwelling, shares a common wall with the dwelling, and has an independent entryway, or attached to the main residence by an enclosed passageway. And then I have an accessory dwelling unit detached.
What's the point of the accessory dwelling attached? What are we trying to accomplish there?
Different size limits. So we'll have where they want grandma to have her own unit in the house, and we can't let grandma do that.
No, so this would allow that.
That would allow that. This would
allow
that.
You can't just call it an extra bedroom, or they would want it like as a grandmother's studio apartment downstairs. It's often done.
Or somebody with their child, maybe. You don't want the kid, your 22-year-old kid, you know, you want to provide housing for them, but
it's like a little separate apartment.
It is.
Yeah, my grandma's place in Colonial Valley had that. It had a full bedroom with a full bath.
Those are everywhere.
Closets upstairs of her garage, which was attached, you know, but it had a separate entrance into it. No kitchen.
They are everywhere, and that's why let's just make the path for it to happen and do it legally and be able to inspect the insulation and the wiring and the plumbing to make sure they're not going to burn up in there.
Well, this one was fully built by a licensed contractor. Bonded, insured, everything.
It's probably on our list of violations, Commissioner Hare.
We're going to get that list much smaller if we approve all this stuff, right?
This will help a lot. I actually had one that was reported to me yesterday. Beautiful, beautiful setup. It's all a violation. It's two homes, two septics. The second home and the second septic were never permitted. They were just... So anyways, what we move on to...
Is Connie getting the taxes off of them? That's all I care.
No.
Most of the time they're assessed that way.
Or the assessed value,
because assessors
rate.
Don't care. I mean, they kind of care, but they don't really care. They shouldn't care.
They just want to know.
They just want to know the value.
Just know that it's there. Well, and honestly, if it's built safe, I don't care either. I just want people to be able to live and not have these houses burning down every other day.
Right. So now we're going to move into the details of it. So if you're located in a UGB and your city has accessory dwelling unit standards, you follow those rules of the city. If your city does not, you follow the rules of the county. And then, so these would apply to, basically in the city of Grants Pass, they have ADU rules, so their UGB goes with Grants Pass. Cave Junction does not. So Cave Junction would follow the county's rules. And then these also apply outside the UGB.
So the city of Cave Junction...
They go by county.
They go by county rules, but do we have rules for urban setting for them?
So they have an urban
rule. So they can have duplexes or something else like that within the city limits of Cave Junction?
Within the city limits, once they're in the city limits, they defer to the city code.
Okay.
But when you're in the UGB, state statutes that become effective July 1st say in a UGB you can have this accessory dwelling unit, but in Cave Junction, what rules do you follow? Because the city doesn't have any ADU rules, so they would have to follow the county ADU rules.
Until they make their own ADU.
Until they make their own.
When they have one, then they can follow theirs.
I don't know about that. I just don't think they have rules, so they can't do it. Because the UGB is very well defined as who's got the planning authority. In fact, in the Grants Pass area, the old UGB is under city jurisdiction as far as planning. The new UGB is still under county jurisdiction as far as planning. Until we sign that IGA, giving them authority to regulate land use outside of the city limits in their old UGB, which there will only be one, right now there's two, it's county code. And that makes a big difference for marijuana grows, which are illegal in the city, but not. In the new UGB, they're still legal because they're under county code. They won't be once the city takes it over and their codes apply. So using those rules, you don't get to necessarily, I think, pick and choose between what... Not having one just means you don't have one. You don't have rules within this. Because I think the governing body, we don't govern those, the UGB.
We do in Cape Junction.
Because they don't have rules that are... we don't have an IGA with them.
But on, when you're talking on the UGB, when you are brought into the UGB, you are going to get city police and fire in that UGB, correct?
Only in the old one, not in the new one.
Not in the new one. When it was brought into the UGB.
That's why we don't have our UGB upgraded.
Let's just think of the new UGB as tentative. It isn't actually 100% approved, all that stuff.
Because they haven't finished their
None of the studies have been finished. There's no IGA signed with that. It's just a...
But the old UGB,
it's
they
almost like a letter... Yes.
Now, in old UGB, do they go by...
Sure they do. Sure they do, Connie.
No.
Absolutely.
The UGB does not get city police and fire unless they have signed an annexation agreement with the city.
But they have the option to do that. They get water.
So they get that when, usually when developers are developing a subdivision, they'll sign that. But there are a lot of people in UGB who do not get police and fire. They're still getting county sheriff as their.
Because I was wondering.
Having to go to one of the fire subscriptions for fire. So it's not automatic.
Don't they pay city?
Only if they've signed this annexation agreement, and not all properties have that.
Okay.
But when you come to marijuana, I've signed an annexation agreement, now I'm under city, police, and fire, and I'm in the UGB, so I'm going to grow marijuana.
Once we sign that IGA, the planning code, whether they get city services or not, they're under that jurisdiction. In the old UGB, that doesn't matter. Our authority for planning, Julie, she doesn't do the old UGB. She only does the new UGB.
And I think it's the city's under no obligation to put water and sewer and every city services out into...
No, they just have a plan.
Because all property taxes go to public safety, and that's the only thing
they're working on right now.
Yeah.
is planning out, you know, how big are the pipes going to be, how's it all going to connect and stuff.
Yeah.
That's what's taken them 5-6 years. I actually been saying that for years. Could be like 7.
Six.
Yeah.
So I'll keep going here. So this is controversial with the state right here. Accessory dwelling units may be permitted in the rural residential, community residential, exclusive farm and farm resource, forest commercial and woodlot resource, limited development in serpentine zoning districts.
That's
pretty much. But
it left out industrial and commercial.
And what happened, but what happens with, so when this, when the Association of Oregon Planning Directors proposed allowing ADUs in the resource zones, there was a lot of pushback. We even said, well, let's do it by conditional use. And as you know, that did not pass. So we will get pushback on the farm and forest resource zones and the forest commercial woodlot resource zones. However, they do allow temporary medical hardships. So our ADUs are called medical hardship dwelling / accessory dwelling unit. So that's how...
To cover them both.
Don't you have to use the word temporary in there, too?
In the definition, it says temporary.
Okay.
So that's how we're going to go that route.
Wow.
Accessory dwelling units are subject...
Can we achieve something in the resource zone as an accommodation of adjusting the minimum revenue? You know, it's like $80,000 a year or something off of EFU. What if we were to adjust that to a more reasonable rate? Marijuana doesn't qualify for that.
Yeah, I think that's set by the state.
I think it is, too.
80-acre
parcels that are zoned EFU, if they generate $80,000 of income, can qualify for an additional dwelling?
Yeah.
Dwelling?
I want to say it's like $40,000 or $80,000. No, you're right.
It's
let's save that battle
later
for another one, because
okay.
I'm not sure if I'd be able to win
yeah,
that one.
If it's not up to us, if we didn't choose it,
sure
the state chose it. But it works well for the Willamette Valley, where they're probably generating that off of 80 acres.
Sure.
But off of smaller truck farm style stuff down here.
And we have smaller, our average farms are much smaller.
Yeah.
So accessory dwelling units are subject to the accessory building size limitations. So in other words, you're not going to get your house and all the 6,000 square feet of accessory buildings and then an ADU too. It's accessory by definition, so it has to fall within those accessory size limitations.
Okay.
Accessory unit dwelling units can only be permitted if it can be demonstrated they will be served by water supply and by an existing or new private on-site sanitary waste disposal system or public sewer. Portable toilets are not permitted. So, accessory dwelling units shall meet Oregon's...
Wait. RVs have portable toilets.
But remember, the accessory dwelling unit is a stick-built structure.
Okay.
So
no composting toilets that are off the grid.
Right. Mm-hmm. Accessory dwelling units shall meet Oregon specialty codes. Accessory dwelling units shall not be rented on a transient or short-term basis. A deed restriction shall be required to ensure the unit will not be rented for a period of less than 30 days to any one party. That is how Jackson County does that as well. Richard, can you make a Kleenex? The area within 50 feet surrounding the accessory dwelling unit on all sides shall be kept free and clear of junk, waste, or flammable material. And that is consistent with our fuel breaks language in the code. We have something that says you have to keep everything clear around
that's
your home.
Senate Bill 360.
So, yeah, so we're just being consistent with that. Number of units. A maximum of one accessory dwelling unit is allowed per lot or parcel. An accessory dwelling unit is not allowed if it would result in being the third or more dwelling unit or third or more unit with sleeping accommodations on the lot or parcel. In other words, if you currently have some stuff out there, we're not going to let you just keep adding accessory dwelling units because you now have a compound, then we're going to run into problems with that. So
two is allowed, not three.
Nope. So you get your home and your accessory dwelling unit.
Okay.
I meant two being primary house with the one.
Yes, yes.
It was sleeping unit, so primary house, accessory dwelling, once you get to anything beyond that.
Right. So then we have detached accessory dwelling units shall not exceed 50% of the floor area of the first floor of the principal single family dwelling on the latter parcel, and in no case shall exceed 600 square feet. So
your accessory dwelling can't be bigger than your house?
Right, because it's accessory.
Can it become the main?
And facetious.
You could. You could get a change of use and flip it around. And then the 600 square feet comes from our old definition of guest house years ago we used to limit the size of them, and that's pretty common that they limit the size of the accessory dwelling units.
It sounds pretty low. There was some of those tiny homes that were 800, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you get into a city, they tend to be much higher, you know, 1,100, 1,200. Mm-hmm. In the rural areas, especially if you're looking at the kind we see where maybe it's a shed, your traditional ADU, they're not exceeding 600.
How big? Yeah, that seems fine. Cause
it's a 20 by 30.
Feet, you've got a 10 by 10 bedroom, which is not, that's a, in a three-bedroom house, you're...
Misspoke.
Yeah, I think you're okay.
Did the math
it's
off.
A 20
by 10, there's 100, you got 500 square feet for a kitchenette, and a living area and a bathroom.
It's a 20 by 30 size. Home.
Yeah, that's big.
So, okay, attached accessory dwelling units shall not exceed 50% of the floor area of the principal single-family dwelling structure to which it is a part of. And then there's no maximum square footage on that. So, because the big house is already there, so you're only getting half.
And you've got a max on how big it has to be?
Just based on the square footage.
Yeah.
So, setbacks. Accessory dwelling units shall meet the same setbacks as required for a new dwelling. Detached accessory dwelling units shall be located within 100 feet of the primary single-family dwelling. And again, we're looking at that from that field break thing again, because...
You said 100 feet?
This one would be 100, right? And again, I'm going back to some of that old guest house stuff that said you had to be within so many feet. And then at one time there was language about... if you were within so many feet, they'd let you hook up to the existing septic. Basically making sure it stays accessory. That it's someplace you're going to run out and talk to grandma.
Is
that
in all zones, or is it what zone? Not everything?
That would be in all of them. It does say, if the applicant is able to provide a new fuel break for the structure, in accordance with Article 76, we would allow that to extend to 150 feet within the primary dwelling. No portion of an existing building that encroaches within a required setback may be converted to or used as an accessory dwelling unit. So in other words, if your neighbor's garage encroaches into your into the setback and you've lived with that garage that way, we're not going to let it now be converted to a house, and now they're having a house 5 feet from their property line. So
something in violation can't be converted.
Right. No new road access shall be allowed to serve the accessory dwelling unit, because it is accessory when we're not looking at two lots. It's, again, supposed to be incidental. All development shall comply with the other applicable regulations outlined in the code. And then we talk about the type of permit you need based on the zone. By state law, that once you get into those resource zones, we have to process permits differently than if you were in a residential zone. So we just clarify exactly what type of permit is required. If this would also allow us to change the use index in the code, which, you know, it's a little chart in the very beginning. It would also require that we change our temporary use standard. So wherever, in any zone, wherever it says medical hardship dwelling, it says medical hardship dwelling / accessory dwelling unit. So they're all treated the same at, so they're treated permit-wise.
So you're not really rid of the medical hardship program.
Well, what
That's
I am...
kind of a false.
What I am doing is getting rid of all the standards for the medical hardship.
Well, why aren't we just removing that type?
Because you need it for the farm use?
No, because
or which one
DEQ,
needed it?
DEQ recognizes the temporary medical hardship.
Okay.
It's the name game. And that is it for accessory dwelling units.
Good start.
Awful lot to absorb. If you can get those printed out, I'd sure like to read it.
Okay. We have them.
Scratch it out.
In our packet so we can get them.
Okay,
I'll
so what I'd like to do next week is, like I said, bring you back another chunk. Maybe take a couple minutes to see if there was anything in here that after you digest it a little bit to think about. I really would like to have most of this hammered out before we get into a public hearing.
Oh, yeah.
It's just going to be too much.
It's going to the Planning Commission?
This has to go to the Planning Commission?
No.
And then to the board for two hearings.
So. I'm just curious. Caleb's here today, and Caleb, as a realtor broker, has done a lot of classes on ADUs and such like that. What comes to mind is, in any of this process, have you thought about bringing someone like him in to talk about from the real estate side of it, any recommendations that they're seeing of needs in the community or things that... Yeah. I would recommend that utilize Caleb as a resource as something... This is a subject he's become very proficient in.
Sure. I also presented these general...
Not to volunteer you, Caleb, but I did.
I was going to say, you're volunteering. Stellar. Thank you, Caleb.
Yeah, I did do a presentation with the Realtors Association on things I was thinking, you know, to try and get feedback. I have had a couple of realtors reach out to me and, you know, question or offer suggestions and stuff like that. And, yeah, definitely sit down with Caleb as well. But right now, this is... Like I said, before I went too far with anything, I wanted to make sure you're okay with that general concept and then just keep working on these.
Concept, yes, for me, as far as I want to find a way to make housing safe and available and affordable. And I'm a fan of grandma and mother-in-law suites and guest houses and all that other kind of stuff. They can be done tastefully and safely and appropriately. Mm-hmm. So the concept, yes, I need time to process and look through the details.
Sure.
This is very limiting because there's an awful lot of people say, well, I want to, and probably have good basis for that. But it's also an opportunity that hasn't been opened before.
Right, and people have to understand we're really pushing the envelope with this. This is, mm-hmm. You're not allowed to have a second home.
Common sense says a lot of that stuff is not pushing the envelope. It's just plain old common sense. But you've got the state involved.
We have to play that game. And people have to understand, compared to what we can give them now, which is really
nothing
other than under the guise of a medical hardship where
everybody's
we're asking doctor reports.
Yeah.
Right.
One of the things that's interesting, and the insurance companies they're a real driving force in just about anything. You put a wood stove in, you bootleg your wood stove in, and your house burns down, and you don't have a permit for that stove, guess what? Insurance companies are off the hook. Is there anything that the insurance industry would say, whoa, wait a minute, you know, you're adding a whole other residence on there, and we don't have a way of putting a price on that?
Well, but
if it's against state code, they're going, whoa, we're not doing anything. And now you've got something out there today at today's present, and maybe that's why we're going to codify something so that it would be accepted by the insurance industry?
So keep in mind, we're requiring them to comply with the Oregon specialty codes, so making sure that insurance companies would be happy. We're making sure we're checking the wiring and the wood.
Yeah, I didn't know what the breaking point is there.
Yeah.
Where you cam over and all of a sudden they go, nope, we're not interested.
And I want to let you know, too, I did share my initial draft with two of our land use consultants as well to see what they thought and to get some feedback from them on that as well. So, okay.
Anybody else in the state doing this? Any other counties that already have?
So Jackson, like I said, they do it with the hot pot and the deed restriction, not to this extent. We're the only county that I am aware of through my planning director's organization that is doing a big comprehensive look like this. Douglas is trying some stuff, and they tried some stuff actually, and I believe it was appealed to LUBA this past month. So
they anticipated that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Anything else for Julie?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Julie.
Yep.
Okay, item number two, quarterly department updates, is A1A is IT, information technology. Here they come.
All right, commissioners.
Morning, sir.
Oh, there they go.
Trying to keep it there.
They're all coming up here.
Thank you. I just want to touch base on some of the projects we're working on and get some feedback on where you think we should head. So patrol headquarters, they remodeled the storage area, the warehouse they had over there behind the jail. So we moved 19 PCs, 15 phones, a new switch to handle capacity out there, and we'll be able to handle the camera system, the download, upload stuff from there. So it was some lifting for that. I think it went pretty well. Unrested growth and movement generally this year. We knew we were going to have so many people added because of the local option levy. But just the movement secondary to that was quite a bit. So there's just, when we move, generally, it causes a lot of issues because we don't have ports where they want to move them to. We don't have switch capacity. We thought we planned it out years ago, but maybe there's a new use. So generally, we probably should have overthought what the expansion meant.
My challenge is that people who move 1 month and then they move the next month. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, we're not doing that. You need to plan out exactly. And our office is probably as big of a user of doing things like that. And it's a problem for me that we don't think these things out and then we just expect you guys, facilities, to pick up the burden.
Sometimes it's personnel issues and they want to move somebody and it's just not a great solution.
There's a couple of people out that just, they move at a whim. And
Well, it probably should be one of the boxes to check when they decide they're going to move. Have you checked with IT first?
And they do. They've gotten much better on that. But it doesn't mean we can drop everything and make it happen.
Correct.
Yeah.
At their, it may require 6 months lead time or something.
It's something. Yeah. Give people a chance to think about it, and they're like, in 6 months, it comes up, and like, I'm okay. It's fine.
We're moving to getting rid of projectors and screens. So we TVs are just getting very affordable from their large size. You can do a lot more with them. So room 157 now has a large monitor and a PC. And the DA, they used phones and iPads to do witness communication remotely. We didn't know that's what they were doing, so we suggested a TV and microphone speaker system, and so we just finished installing that yesterday. So far it's working well and they're going to use it a lot, so that's good. Website, so
can we go back to that for just a
second? Sure.
Yesterday I suggested to Wendy, so she anticipated, rightfully so, 100 people to come to the weekly business session, and less than 25 showed up. Sorry, I have something in my eye. The point being that she does that every week, trying to anticipate, and she has been instructed, and so has Terry and Linda before her, that we will not be short on agendas at a weekly business session. I hate wasting the paper if people don't show up. My thought was is to somehow either put it on the projector or there's a dedicated screen that Jury uses back behind that maybe we just leave out, and she can do it right from her computer, and it has the agenda electronically out in front of everybody so they can just follow along.
They can scroll down. She can scroll it as we're...
Or the whole thing is published or scroll. See, some of them are kind of long. I'm just alleviating the need to try to anticipate how many people are attending a particular meeting up there. One element of efficiency, and I don't know if we need new infrastructure to do it. I don't know. Just a thought.
You could use a large screen TV on the side wall. On the...
I think there's one back behind the curtain.
On the stand, it's fairly old, but we can take a look at it.
It's small, too. So as far as people seeing it and the movement to get over to it. But, I mean, would you put it in the lobby so they could see it from the lobby side, or would you put it in the main room so they could see where it's at?
While you're sitting in the gallery,
you
should be able to follow along if that can happen.
Oh, it can happen.
So they can say, gee, we know what's coming up, or I'm going to stick around for this.
Well, we have presentations come up, but if you have your first slide and at the end of the presentation, it goes back to the agenda on the screen. I don't think that's such a problem. So maybe
we literally could print the agenda every week on a large map and put it on an easel for now.
I like the electronic element of it. It's just
saving the paper,
and it's easy, and it's up to date. Our agendas change sometimes in the last minute. Just a thought. I don't mean to be
we can take a look at that
presentation.
Something I can price it out. So the website review group's moving along. Commissioner Morgan's on it. We've met with a company that kind of facilitates what do we actually want to accomplish with the new website. And we've taken a look at one website that has a very large market share for government agencies. They only do government agencies. And what we're trying to do is review enough information so that when we do go out for a request for information or for a proposal, that we've got our bases covered about what's out there. We're finding some new technology that I didn't know existed. But the biggest thing is the access to the citizens through mobile devices. That's a huge issue, and it becomes more and more apparent every day. And pretty much every new website out there addresses that in a pretty solid way. I put the position justification for the web developer on your desks. If you could take a look at it the next day or two, and let me know if you've got any feedback on changing that.
Looks good. Arthur and I talked about it 2 weeks or whenever, a week ago, and the ISF can afford it. I think it applies to every program, maybe not equally, but it's certainly along the lines of improving our transparency, which this website will do. Mm-hmm. It goes a long way. And we have suffered the consequences of not having a dedicated PIO and commissioners attempt virtuously to try to shore up the difference, and it doesn't ever work. So getting us on some sort of a schedule with doing 30-second minute videos is just one element of what needs to be accomplished. In our own words, you need to be talking about X, Y, or Z, putting it out there on a video, all of that stuff. So if that's the vision for this thing, both to integrate with the website, publicizing our sale coming up, you know, that's not Helene's wheelhouse, it's certainly not mine, it's not Commissioner DeYoung's. Having somebody who's, that's what they do, mm-hmm. and making it happen would I think pay dividends. So I appreciate you being forward-thinking and putting this, taking the bull by the horns and putting it into your program. I'm not sure if it stays there forever, but it certainly needs to start somewhere.
Well, and the idea, I think, that we try to talk about where we go, and with it being that, John, your department has tended to be our support for any of the, recordings and the mass meetings we're having or anything like that, you know, so it kind of, that's where it started. But the idea, too, is that we make sure that we have consistent messaging getting out, that we have it on multiple platforms, that it's not just the website, and that we have someone available to help us get that message out, but also making sure the website's working and all that other kind of stuff. But the more ideas, I don't know, I think it was a good call.
And how does it integrate with the sheriff's positions that have varied for PIO focus? Is this a duplication, or can we consolidate?
Sheriff doesn't currently have anyone that's a PIO. He's kind of his own PIO.
Doing
right
it
now.
Himself. Yeah. I know that Gilbertson had a PIO.
Yeah, there isn't one hired right now.
Okay.
Unless you know otherwise.
Nope. Yeah. Sheriff's been doing a pretty darn good job of it. I mean, it's not
everybody. That's perfect.
I see the position almost, especially at the beginning, there'll be some lifting for technology, but mostly they're going to be working with the departments. They're not going to be working with IT at all. Fairgrounds effort, we've met with Hunter a couple times. We had some engineering work done from Hunter's end, what it would take to do a pretty solid job of wireless availability out there. Hunter did Jackson County's fairgrounds. Mm-hmm. They've come with a pretty solid professional offer that we're still working on. How much advertising can Peggy trade for monthly costs, and how much infrastructure costs can we propose? So we budgeted some for that. Probably in the next few weeks we'll be bringing a proposal to the board supporting Peggy's effort. But the idea is to get the floral pavilion buildings, the arena, and what's the building called?
Commercial
building, wired up so vendors can then pay a premium for access for their POS point of sale stuff, so the public can use it. It's a gigabyte of data that Hunter's proposing, which is extremely solid. We provide 40 megabytes typically in the county, so you're talking about a factor of, 20 times that, so that we'd be able to handle crowds at the fair. And
live streaming of our state of the county address could be very...
Yeah, we may find that we use the fairgrounds a lot more for activities like that because of the wireless training. You could train 100 people if that's what you wanted to do. Hunter's been extremely solid as a vendor for us in the past. We know the people pretty well now, and they do a solid job. And they're in it for as much exposure as they are to make a profit. They tend to make not a lot of money off of us. And so we think we... It's a good to work with your local government, and that's just the way they've been,
great.
I think. So we'll be bringing that to you in the next few weeks. Could be very exciting for the fairgrounds program and the parks efforts out there. Planning effort with SmartGov. Julie just left, but the go-live is Monday, finally. I will tell you that SmartGov has had some bumps along the way, and I think it's a symptom that other software companies are going through. The economy's good. People are buying software. They are doing, they're developing where they haven't developed in a long time. And the people that they put on projects are really, really important. If you get the new people, you don't get quality projects. And it's one of those, I think, another evidence of how a project manager is extremely important. So what we get from a department is that they act as the project manager in the absence of...
And they don't have the bandwidth.
And they're busy. They're, you know, they go through projects. I know Parks is doing the campground reservations. You know, every project that someone, a department head, comes and says, well, it's going to cost this and take this much time, you can pretty much double it right off the bat. They're going to not be good at estimating the effort that it takes.
Right.
The assessor being an exception because they've gone through this before. But having somebody on the staff who's got some IT savvy in a department or just general project experience is a real, real solid thing. But I know Douglas County has at least two project managers on their IT staff. That, and I'm not asking for that position, but the IT staff, they'll have four or five projects on their agenda,
right.
And they'll follow it all the way through. And when you have an IT person on their end, on the vendor's end, you better have somebody that can talk the language and hold their feet to the fire.
Yeah.
Because projects get delayed real quick just because somebody went on vacation and when they came back, they weren't ready to go. Or they had, you know, something really going on in their own department.
It's kind of like the evaluations that we've, you know, you guys asked for in the city and we've asked for. If you don't have somebody other than that manager of that program, it's no wonder that you get whatever you get. Having that third party.
Well, if you have the manager of the program, they may not... They won't ask for help because they think what they know is the entirety of the project. But you've got another outside person that says, oh, no, you've been down that path before, so-and-so.
How do we make sure what they're getting in planning, what they're doing in building and safety for their online permitting, and what the assessors is doing? If it does have or a need to talk from, hey, we just permitted this new house. Have you guys put it in your schedule? And in 6 months, when it's supposed to be complete, that assessor goes out, you know, there's some sort of a ding. All of that is somewhat coordinated right now, but if there was an electronic version that just
did it automatically,
I don't know. I'm just thinking outside.
Well, what I think we need to do is when a department head comes to the board with a project like that, is that we have a couple meetings. We all get together. We say, what is it going to take? What's the timing like? Have you thought about this? Does this necessitate a part-time project manager?
Right.
Because you can do that. You can hire a 20-hour-a-week person that can do that.
The struggle is that who has the authority to call such a meeting? Is it you? Is it the program who's doing it? Is it the liaison to that? It just, you having a central...
Yeah, it's partially responsible for me, and I'm learning that I sometimes have to push back when I'm not. And so when a department head says, I've got to do this, and this is a really good idea... And we say, well, we can handle our IT side of it. We can do that. Like the sheriff's cameras, purely IT. When, you know, facilities might help us wireless access point, but not a big issue. But when you do something like a software that a department hasn't used before, this is new to them, I think we need to really say, okay, let's get together, who are the parties involved, and slow it down, and do we have the resources? That's all, that's the biggie. Do we have the resources to do it?
Well, I think they do that, you know, for instance, when they're going to do a development, you get bring, there's a box on there that says, did you check with the irrigation district? There's a box on it, did you check with these other departments to see if they're going to get involved? If they say, nope, I've looked at it, glass out, irrigation district doesn't have anything to do with this, move it along. Then there should be, if you're saying IT should be brought in as one of those boxes on every project to say,
pretty much almost everyone.
And let you make the distinction whether or not you need to get involved or not, if IT is involved or not, and to what extent.
Facilities is the same way. They're often hearing about something kind of tangentially.
Yeah.
And some of that's just me.
The card is very far down the field when it's like, well, wait a second, you can't take out that wall. You can't explain that. Good point, John.
Commissioner Morgan had put something in front of me from a meeting that she had gone to, and I said, oh, well, okay, we'll look at that. We get a lot of info. But it turned out to be pretty good.
It's like, I don't like you guys going to conferences.
Yeah, because they get ideas. But we had briefly touched with this effort. It's a national government effort. It's all levels, federal government, FBI, Homeland Security, counties, tribals. And what they're doing is they share information about vulnerabilities, attacks, cyber attacks on agencies, government agencies in particular. And I can't tell you how big this issue is getting. You saw Klamath's issue. City of Atlanta was a massive. They literally took every PC off a desk and formatted the hard drive and started over. The vulnerabilities, the cleanup effort after one of these things is just huge. And this effort helps us. Information is great. The ability to respond to information is even better. But it's a route that we can at least respond to and look at. And so what we've done is agreed that if we have an attack, we'll share our information. And the more public this gets, the better. Because a lot of agencies a few years ago, oh no, nothing happened, but something did happen.
Right.
And if they had shared the information, it would have been better for everybody.
But they were looking at their own personal liability of people questioning their ability to deal with it. Yeah, so.
So now it's so prevalent, it's like flooding. You can't stop the river. You can't prepare for that kind of thing. Once 100 years, now it's everywhere.
So this group actually has presented in two of the conferences I've gone to this year. They were at the NACO Legislative Conference in Washington, D.C., and I went to the technology town hall that first day, and they presented, and I got the information. Then they were at the one in Tacoma and had a chance to follow up and get more information, and so just as following up. But it's kind of one of those things that it's shocking just how much it's going. And
I think the more when a guy goes in to do this, to Josephine kind of says, I'm going to crash there, I'm going to get everything, and you have something already in place, they go, whoa, I think I have to move on to somebody else. They're going to go for the easiest. And the person that doesn't have anything, protections, is going to be the vulnerable one. And that's the easy target.
Our greatest point of vulnerability, John, you correct me, is staff doing something, letting somebody in.
Social engineering.
Yeah.
Making someone believe something that is good for them,
yeah,
and they do the wrong thing.
I want to see something on this. I want to see an annual training that people sign a letter that says it has to be serious. I don't want people to sit in a room for a half an hour while they're on their phones. And you know, it doesn't have to be long. It's not something you do from your desk. You are going to have to come to the fairgrounds. And for a half an hour, John is going to instill the fear of God in you, or somebody is, to say, this is serious, this is something you can prevent, get Smokey the Bear up there, whatever. It's up to us. That's the first deal. I mean, that stuff that people are going to get in through a back door or whatever, that's going to be really challenging, and that's in your wheelhouse, and you're going to deal with that. But most of it is us opening an email that says, click here for free tickets to Bahamas, or I don't know, whatever it looks like.
That's what I, for my own personal thing,
just dumb.
I would like some training because you guys recognize fishing and all that other stuff, but I probably wouldn't.
Well, he catches a lot in his spam thing. I just, you know.
Ten to one. So we get 30,000, we get 23,000 emails a day.
Yeah.
You only see 2,300.
Right.
And that's spam.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, and we've been, our BCC line, we've been getting a lot lately that have been getting through the spam. And so it's kind of one of those things that it's like usually it catches and then all of a sudden you'll see a flow of them that
so
aren't.
They adapt.
They adapt.
Yeah. Figure out what's going to get through.
Yeah.
She's right. I've gotten two or three of those.
RBC?
No, in my email.
The BCC one I've seen some lately.
But it doesn't make the quarantine.
Where it comes through and it's a you know, send us a $10,000 cashier check and we'll send you $1 million style or whatever like that.
Some of the ones I saw this week were Chinese pictures, ladies and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, none of us are getting into porn, but that's the invitation that was getting through. And
yeah.
I just deleted, didn't open it even. You know, it's just
You can tell really quickly that it's like not.
When I sold a couple cars on eBay and whatnot, and I've deposited the money in your PayPal account. It's already there, and they send you a receipt from PayPal that they put $60,000 in your account. If you look through it, the only way I look through it is if punctuation's wrong in one or two places or a misspelled word. And PayPal never does that. I had a guy that did that on a Mustang, and I kept him on the line. And PayPal says, can you keep him on the line? I said, you bet. He's in the Azores, is what he told me. He's in a merchant ship going to the Azores, and he's got all this ready to go, and I'm going to send the transporter to pick it up, and you need to pay him $1,250. And the car would have been gone. I'd have been out $1,250, and everything's gone. So I kept him on the line, and finally PayPal called me back and says, got it. And they, you know, thank you very much for stringing this guy along. So it can be corrected, but I just look for misspelled words and punctuation.
And it's not just coming in via email.
But I shouldn't have to do that.
It's a phone call. Somebody can call and say, I'm so-and-so from a state agency or whatever. I need access to your blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody gives it to them. My grandmother went down and tried to wire money. She thought I was in jail in Las Vegas. I was at the house. She's old, but whatever. They are smart.
That's a common one.
They're smart. Yeah. They figure it out.
Oh, my nose was broke. That's why I sound different.
She was in town.
Yeah.
So, John, that's real important. We're
because
behind
I'm
100%.
Okay.
Whatever we can do.
Okay.
And cyber risk insurance is becoming a topic around counties. So we have 50,000 in our CIS policy. We've used it once, maybe 6-7 years ago. So JJ's going to look at that. To me, it'd be kind of a quagmire. How do you prove that you met all the conditions of it? But the bigger counties are buying it. Lane County, Multnomah.
They are. They're buying catastrophic.
They're buying larger.
Their first dollar.
They're
Lane self-insured.
Well, they're buying separate
yes.
Risk management policies.
Catastrophic.
Yeah.
Big
yeah.
stuff. That's for replacing every PC or what?
In the event of a disaster,
we should
that
definitely
way.
Consider that.
So he'll probably look into that and bring you something.
My insurance deal is if our fiscal situation improves stability, you reduce your insurance and you self-insure. We used to be self-insured back in the day, and we can't afford that now. But there are steps and measures you can take. But the catastrophic one is everybody does it, and we should do it.
Mark.
Yeah.
So that's what I have for you today. Is there anything for me?
Yes. I would like, if it's possible, for you and Ryan to coordinate on a presentation on our radio infrastructure. Anything else that you think is pertinent to that? Either you or Ryan or I have all talked tangentially about the delta. We've got, you know, easily $500,000 of maintenance stuff that needs to happen. We're going into our budget. It's a little late for that now, but we could probably, you know, shore up some elements or look at a plan to do what you guys are going to suggest. Doesn't have to be, you know, maybe before the end of the budget year, into June style stuff. But making sure that my proposal is to take, and I think we're doing that in this budget, take all these cell phone tower leases. And I know the fairgrounds and parks and forestry and everybody's got these things. nickel and diming it, putting it together, maybe it's around $50,000-$60,000 of revenue, and that be dedicated as a trust. But in the meantime, until that builds up, what do we need to do to make sure that our radio infrastructure isn't going to go down next year in the middle of winter and have it really expensive to try to go up there and fix it or whatever? So
I'm not sure the right venue. I know with the potential, the city's already started the demolition or through demolition phase of moving to their new location with the police department, which will affect our dispatch.
I hope it does.
And there's been talk about potentially co-locating and potentially leasing and stuff like that, but who needs to be in those conversations as far as our needs being met? I know the sheriff has had initial conversations with the chief, but just wanting to make sure that we're planning ahead and having, because one other piece that we would look at is if they put an EOC in there, we potentially, we have our EOC and just emergency management also being part of those conversations. But I don't know that you guys have been at that table in those conversations.
No, we have to be, and I brought it up. Depending on what that looks like, my discussions with dispatch would be that if they co-locate, they would be leasing GP's equipment, but they would still need to talk to our patrolmen, our departments from there, so we would need some kind of connectivity to that. Hunter runs fiber regularly local. We should probably do that sooner rather than later.
And they weren't talking about leasing GP's equipment. They were talking about providing office space, our equipment. So, anyhow.
This is a first opportunity for you to try to implement your
coordinated
effort. So, whatever the board needs to do to help that out.
Okay. It's going to be your level decisions on really the long-term effects of whether we just co-locate or we actually use a 911 as a 911 center.
I would like your guys' recommendation. Commissioner DeYoung is the liaison to both the sheriff's office and your program, so I think it kind of makes sense for one-stop shop. You don't have to be an expert. That's not your role.
I won't be an expert.
No, that's not your role. Your role is to relay, you know, a coordinated effort between the city, the sheriff, IT, facility, whatever's necessary, and bring the board a recommendation.
I've been involved just because of being the 911 board liaison and emergency management. So from those two departments talking about it, that's where my involvement has been. So
the history, though, on the decision to make a sheriff's dispatch center didn't take into account the problems that we are having and are likely to continue to have. And
switch whatever can be improved in those things when we make the transition, that's the time to do it in my mind.
Has technology made it easier to have your own dispatch center than harder? I mean, I'm assuming that everything was all jumbled into one because it worked, but if we're finding it's not working?
They aren't jumbled into one. We have 911, and we have our own sheriff's.
Our own dispatch.
And there should be. There shouldn't even be one in Josephine County. There should be a regional one, probably located in Jackson County, that does Douglas, Jackson, Klamath, Josephine. I mean, that would be what I would like to see.
We don't have any regional ones that do that yet in the state. They have regionals within a county or in metro area, but we don't have any regional dispatch yet beyond what Jackson County is doing that has multiple agencies.
It would be great, though. I mean, if everybody has an opportunity to go through a central, everybody's talking about fire stuff or major catastrophe disasters, they're fortified,
They do have, under the incident command, the fire stations all do have radios that go, and there's open networks in the law enforcement statewide as well. But as far as 911, the state requires each county to have a primary, a PSAP, they call it, a primary public safety answering point. And so right now, Grants Pass Public Safety is that PSAP, and then the state police and sheriffs are secondary, where they get 911 transferred to them. And there's still stuff there. But anyhow, because of those other two departments I'm working with, those have been conversations. Because of what you said about needing to be brought in earlier, I want to make sure that you're a part of those conversations. And it might be worth, as far as reaching out to the sheriff and saying, can we make sure that IT is and facilities are part of this conversation up front?
Yep.
So that's what I have.
I need a follow-up with you and probably have facilities, but the Frontier communication issues that we're still having, there's been some discussion about, just kind of follow up with what Commissioner Harris said about radios and infrastructure, but there was a request of, right now as Frontier phones go down, people can't access 911. And as far as looking at, is there any infrastructure opportunities that we would partner with to try to assist in that? And I know we used to do the radio waves to get the IT out to the valley, but over the mountaintops, but I know we've changed some things. I'd like to follow up with you with a conversation of just brainstorming and show you what Frontier came back with me after my meeting with Representative Walden and just kind of see what our next steps can be.
Yeah, as long as Ryan's there too. Because
yes.
Really, okay.
Okay, any other questions?
No, that's great.
Thank you very much,
John. Moving on to item number 3, other business. I don't have anything. Board business?
Yeah. The Arthur's not here, but I want us to put on the schedule for when you're available, Commissioner DeYoung, the $425,000 borrowed from the road fund for safety. I don't know where that is in the budget this year, but really, I don't want it to. Arthur had suggested it not be in the proposed budget, but it be a element we could do before the end of the fiscal year in a supplemental. I don't know where you guys stand on that. I think I've heard support, but
I'm okay with that. I want to pay it back.
Okay.
But we haven't received the money yet. So we can.
We will soon. Okay. We will before the end of the fiscal year from both Secure Rural School Shoring Up and Health. So those are checks that will be in the mail. I received word yesterday from Rocky from the Department of Interior, the person who facilitates the Secure Rural Schools payments under the BLM, and they are not putting. They are not assessing Title III and Title II to the shared receipt component, just the appropriated dollars that shore up the Secure Rural Schools. $4.1 million, $2.2 came from shared receipts, so $1.9 is in the Secure Rural Schools package. That's the only portion that gets Title II and Title III removed from it. It's huge. It means about $3 million to the ONC counties for this 17 payment, and our portion of that is 12.5%, so it's not chump change. A couple hundred grand?
Yeah, 360.
Yeah, it'd be great. So, yeah.
Okay.
That's real positive. What else was there? Anybody else have anything?
Anything else? Commissioner?
Depositions we did yesterday?
Yeah.
Took all day, got done a little after 4, so opportunity there just to, I don't know, it was a new experience, so I wouldn't say it was enjoyable, but I felt it was valuable. I am following up with trying to get emergency management contract. I'll follow the legal and see where we're at with that.
Good.
I touched base with Wally last week just as an update, and so I need it. The city's reached out, they need it. And so I'm going to go follow up with him right now.
Okay. I going back to yesterday's discussion about, or was it Tuesday, about the Second Amendment ordinance versus resolution versus board order, whatever.
Yeah.
I would like to leave it as an ordinance because it's got the most teeth.
Sounds good.
You know, I that would be my recommendation. I think just wanted to bring it up to you two. You know, just the fact that while he was asked to look for, you know, various other things around the state, and he had numerous ordinances with which to craft ours off of. And I think an ordinance to me is probably, rather than just a resolution of somebody coming along 4 boards from now and says, let's just take that. I agree.
I'm sorry. It was my misunderstanding that I thought everybody else was doing just resolutions to kind of codify their current positions. But I'm okay with the ordinance too.
Okay. I want Fairgrounds to come in, Peggy to come in on Tuesday, just in our general discussion, to kind of let the board know what her plans are and so on and so forth moving forward. she has some plans for her future, I think, that we all need to weigh in on, and how the structure of the fairgrounds would go, look moving forward. I met yesterday with, you know, I had, well, let's see, it was Monday, on the proposal. It was kind of a, it was a kind of a dream thing, and it was interesting. But I just met yesterday with Dustin Gerlitz on a couple of things. One of them was the fairgrounds, and how that whole thing, because there were some issues about the horse race, and people thought there was cement inside of the handrail, and no, it's going to be grass. It's not going to be turf. It's going to be grass. In case a jockey goes over the rail, there were some real serious issues with storm drainage and things of that sort, mud from the track getting into the they've got all of that handled. Met with Justin yesterday for about 2 hours, and we went over the whole thing. And so I think maybe we'll have a presentation. I think it needs to get past Jennifer and company over there. But I feel very confident that it's going to be a good project. I do want to talk to, I'm going to set up an appointment, and Justin agrees he's going to go with me, to talk to Travis Boersma and Jennifer as to there was a doubt raised, and I want to curb that doubt. Mm-hmm. As to what their project entailed and what it would look like in the future. So I want to make sure we get that. Another thing that we did talk to, Justin and I had lunch with Public Works Director Mr. Brandis, and then yesterday the subject came up when Justin and I met. And I think what we're going to do is, I think our big problem that we've had out, one of our problems and the solution being, we're going to kind of brand it as a new way of looking at things in engineering out there. At Public Works, it's going to be solution-based engineering, to where instead of just saying no to everything coming in and it gets to us, we're going to look at it for solution-based. How can it get done? How can these projects move forward in a timely fashion and not create such a headache? Now, how that shapes up, whether it's privatizing.
There's a fundamental flaw in attitude out there.
Yeah, that's okay exactly that. Right. I get that.
Something will change by the end of June, I'll propose.
Yeah, so we're working on it right now. So just to let you know, it's not a subject that we're just shoving aside and giving you lip service. We're actually working on it. So, okay? So that's all I have.
Along those lines, if I may, what is the plan for the Merlin project, sidewalk project?
What is the plan?
No, it starts Monday.
I'm just astounded that there isn't like some sort of community pre-construction meeting that explains to everybody, or at least the opportunity to sit down. This is a standard thing that
it major, should be a standard
major
thing.
Projects.
This one here, this is an exact example, as I've said to Rob Brandis, and I think you and I agree on that. If you ever want to pick a case study of how not to do a project, this is it.
And I'm not getting any, like,
this
you're carrying tons of water, Commissioner DeYoung.
Yes, I am.
I'm not getting anything out of Public Works that is, like, proactive to this. Where is this meeting scheduled for this Friday to talk about what's going to be going on for 2 months? How the road's going to be closed? I don't even know. People have been asking me, and I have no answers. I direct them to you, which is a lot of pressure. And my frustration is that this, and I'm not pointing that at you, I'm pointing at it Public Works.
Yes.
It's not translating to them.
This is
you need to get off your chair, get involved in the game mm-hmm. proactively, and I hope they listen to this. I'm about had it with that program
and
their inability to see what the citizens are demanding and carrying some water for this board. We are getting seriously chastised out there for what should have been a very positive program.
Should have been. From the very beginning,
so far,
it should have been a positive program.
It's begrudgingly coming forward and looking for potential solutions.
Yeah.
Where is the solution for the water drainage program? Mr. Brandis should be here today talking about that. He should be talking about the pre-meeting, pre-construction meeting. That isn't happening, and I don't know why.
And this, like I said, this is a prime example of how not to do it. Those are all very good points. Today is Thursday. Tomorrow's Friday. The parade is Saturday. For us to have a pre-construction meeting the day before the parade, I understand that, Commissioner.
But I'm not pointing this at you, and I'm not asking you to defend it.
I know that. I'm not going to defend it because I can't defend it. there's no defense for how this project was laid out from the very beginning.
I'm holding back my dissatisfaction. Yeah. My dissatisfaction.
Well, I don't think you're
No, I am.
Doing a pretty good job.
But so, that's what I wanted to convey. I am holding back. Because we are carrying water on this silly project that you said...
And there should be... Every project should be well, well planned out in advance.
What I'm looking for is the indication that this program gets it. And I struggle with that. You get it. 110%. It's not translating. So...
Loud and clear.
Great.
Anything else? Okay, then we are adjourned at 10:30.